Bow hunters are some of the hardest working hunters there are. Most of us work hard all year long just to get a couple weekends or burn our vacation time to sit in a tree. And just like the American blue collar worker, we're trying to balance work, family, faith, and a little time for ourselves in the great outdoors. Now let me introduce you to Trollco Clothing, a brand built by blue collar workers for blue collar workers. Workwear, comfortable tees, hoodies and hats for both men and women, Trollco represents the hardworking American. So whether you're operating heavy equipment, wrenching on engines, or in a factory living that shift life, Trollco has your back, literally. Head to trollco.com/hunting. That's trollco.com/hunting and enter the discount code Empire25 for 25% off of your first order. Trollco, for the hardworking American. This time of year, you're going to find me jigging for crappies off my father-in-law's boat, celebrating a successful turkey hunt, or just sitting on the back deck watching time go by with a quality cigar from Thompson Cigar. Thompson Cigar has been around since 1915, offering the widest array of cigars and cigar accessories at very affordable prices. Thompson Cigar offers your favorite brands like Swisher Sweets, Cohiba, Backwoods, and Monte Cristo shipped fresh directly to your door. Also, be sure to check out their 5-pack fever deals and join their value club for big savings. Visit thompsoncigar.com and enter the discount code SE at checkout for 20% off of all orders over $75. Thompson Cigar, quality cigars at affordable prices.
You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable. Interstate Batteries offers a wide variety of batteries for your everyday needs. Stop into one of their thousands of retail locations and talk with a battery specialist about batteries for your truck, trail cameras, and even those weird batteries for your rangefinder. Interstate Batteries even offers cell phone repair in certain locations. For more information, visit interstatebatteries.com. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.
Hey there, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of the Pennsylvania Woodsman Podcast. I am your host, Mitchell Shirk, and we are rolling right along through the month of February here. Things are drastically warming up. If you've been paying attention at all to the past couple episodes, if you've been listening to any of the last few that we've had, you've noticed that we're talking about things that are in the realm of planning and preparation of next season. And if you've listened to this show long enough, you know that I have a dire interest in food plots and a passion for private land stuff. It's what I grew up doing and being around. I used to remember the first time that I started planting food plots and just seeing how connecting habitat, quality, and hunting strategy came together. And it's just a passion of mine. And that's part of the reason why I got into the career that I'm in as an agronomist. You know, I started off as a biology degree and hoping to get into something that would involve me working with wildlife and whitetails and of such. And, you know, some cool stuff has happened from the time that I started this journey to where I'm at now as a row crop agronomist. But one thing's for certain, it's just allowed me to get more knowledge, more experience, all wrapped around food plots to the point where I feel really comfortable working with people and making recommendations. And some of that knowledge that I've acquired, in fact, a lot of that knowledge acquired was helped retained by this week's guest. So this week we are speaking with my boss, Eric Rosenbaum. Eric is, and he'll introduce himself, but he's the owner of our company, Rose Tree Consulting. He's a wealth of knowledge. You know, he's done a ton of speaking engagements over the years and worked with a ton of clients here in Pennsylvania. as a crop consultant, and you know he wears a lot of different hats, but you know his true passion is agronomy. And we kind of dive in this week talking about just the basics and how not to overlook the simple things like soil condition and soil testing. We go through what a soil test looks like, how to address it, how to amend the soil properly, and set yourself up for success in the long run. We kind of go through what types of soil amendments are out there to address the deficiencies you might see on your soil test, which might be the right direction for you and which might not be. You know, we kind of let that up to you, but based on what's available to you and how to make that work depending on the size of your food plots. This is a great episode for you to not only learn a ton from, because Eric is he's a very well-spoken individual, does a very good job of explaining things in a way that folks can understand it, even if you're not a soil nerd, and even if you are somebody that's interested in soil health, soil fertility, you still learn a ton from him and the way he dissects things. And I was really appreciative to have him as a guest on the show. And I really hope that you enjoy this week's episode. I hope it's something that helps you plan. You know, now with this warm weather, the ground is thawed out. Now is the time to get your soil test and do the preparation you need to set yourself up for success this fall. So, again, hope you enjoy this episode. Let's get into it. Get the ball rolling here. So, we are rolling in Eric's nice, pretty office here. And I have to ask you, of all the speaking engagements you've done, have you ever done a podcast?
No. I mean, I think I've probably done over 200 speaking engagements over the last 10 years, but they've all been in person and webinars. Nothing's been a podcast, so this is a new one.
And of all the things that you would get asked to do, it had to be one for an outdoor hunting one, and it wasn't actually agronomically speaking. So, of course, it was that.
Yeah, no, I'm excited. I love to talk about hunting. I don't get to hunt as much as I used to, but I still really enjoy it.
Yeah, so we're rolling here with my boss Eric Rosenbaum. So thank you for taking some time and doing this with me. This is great.
Yeah, absolutely.
So you he said the time thing is big, and we talk about that all the time. But when I asked you about doing this a few weeks ago, it was right at the time where you had like all kinds of speaking engagements lined up. I was like, I don't really think I want to ask him for one more thing on his plate, so I'm glad it worked out when it did.
Yeah, this is great.
Did you so right now we're in the heart of, you know, our winter season, which involves a lot of meetings and involves a lot of speaking engagement. You said you've done how many speaking engagements over the years, mostly all agronomic stuff, so that kind of we're kind of skirting around what you do. I'll let you introduce yourself and kind of talk about, you know, how you started your business and go from there.
Yeah, so my name's Eric Rosenbaum. I call myself like the senior agronomist of Rose Tree Consulting.
I love that title, by the way, underneath your email, the senior agronomist.
Yeah, I call myself the senior agronomist because I really don't like calling myself the owner of Rose Tree Consulting. It's not that I'm very proud to be the owner of Rose Tree Consulting, but you know, for any business to succeed, it has to be because of the team that you put in place. And to call myself the owner of it takes away from just all the contributions that our team gives. So I take the role of senior agronomist, right? I feel like that makes me just the oldest person on the team.
You don't have that many gray hairs. That's good.
But it hopefully it gives the connotation that we're more of a team and we do things together. And so we started, Rose Tree started in 2009. And, you know, our business is doing a lot of crop scouting and getting out into the field with our customers and doing soil testing and giving them recommendations. And, you know, in some ways it transitions over into wildlife management, because we're all kind of looking for the same thing, right? We want high quality forage and soils that produce, because whatever we invest in our soil, whether it's, you know, we're investing in corn seed to run the combine through and sell that corn, or we're investing in clover seed to grow monster bucks, like we want it to work. And so a lot of what we do is working with our customers to make sure that they can reach their end goal. So like if your goal, and I know your goal, is to put out as many food plots as you possibly can and shoot as many giant bucks as you possibly can. Like there's a soil component to that. We want to make sure that whatever we're doing in the soil is going to lead to enough forage, enough biomass production that it's going to draw these animals in, and they're going to feel comfortable coming in, not just in September, but they're going to be there in June, July, August. They're going to be there in November, December. Like it's a place they want to be. And that can really start with soil testing and how people prepare that food plot for the year to come.
Absolutely. And you started Rose Tree on your own in 2009, right?
Yeah.
So then it was 2017 you had me on. It's been a downhill spiral ever since. Seriously, when did you realize at the point when I was started working with you, you're like, this guy kind of has a little bit of a problem?
Yeah. Well, I think people need to know how you and I came to work together. Like that story is just pretty funny.
Oh, that is
a
classic.
Right. And so that story is I get a call from your wife's grandmother saying that her granddaughter has met this really nice young man and he's working at the game commission and it's a seasonal job and it's going to come to an end. And well, don't you have anything that he could do after his game commission job ends? And I'm like, Yeah, we do.
Do I really want to open that can of worms?
But I think the funniest part was, you know, I call you up to just to talk to you and, mm-hmm. and say, hey, you know, what are you doing this fall? And do you want to get together for breakfast? And you're like, yeah, well, I'm hunting. I could come and meet you for breakfast. So I think you were hunting that morning and you got out of the tree stand, drove, and we met for breakfast, and you went back to the tree stand right afterwards.
You bet you. It was funny because that fall, so when that job came to an end and I was in a lull period, you know, I was talking with you and was looking at a lot of other jobs. That's pretty much all I did was just look for jobs, and I just hunted that whole time just because it was like, I got free time. I can do what I want. And Leanne was like, you need a sense of direction really, really bad. She's like, you have no organization going on right now. If this continues, there's no way we're going to last.
But it's been her phone call was like a little old angel giving me a call and being like, hey, this is what you need. Right. And it was just awesome to have that. And it's just awesome to have you on our team and just everything that you bring and your passion and your drive. And
well, before
even
we get too
what
sappy,
you do
I'm
for
cut
hunting,
you off now.
Right. Like, let's try, like you have a passion for hunting. And
sure.
I mean, like you're out scouting for customers, but you're taking pictures of turkeys and you're taking pictures of deer. And I think you're working, but you're actually looking for sheds. And
I don't find too many.
But you definitely have a passion for this. And so like I enjoy just listening to your stories and I enjoy being here today, being part of this.
Well, thank you. It's definitely been interesting. It's fun to see it. I think the first month of me working with you, you said like, hey, I have this client that has deer hunting related questions. Can you go meet with him? I'm like, this is like week two of my job. What's next in store? So it's been interesting. But, you know, you were talking in the beginning, and I want to kind of circle back. We were talking about what we actually do. And I find it really interesting because I have people ask me all the time, what do you do? What do you do? And I try to explain, you know, that we're a third-party consulting company and how that works. And, you know, if somebody has a very, very beginner level knowledge of agronomy, there's still so many questions and trying to interpret it. So like when people ask you what you do, whether that's somebody that's, you know, you're out on a farm and a neighbor that to that farm walks out and says, like, what are you doing? Like, how do you communicate that? Because I always find myself like bouncing all over the place to try to make sense for people.
Yeah, I think there's a couple ways to look at it. You know, if you're looking at it from like that super high level, like it's our job to work with our customers to make the complex simple. And we're doing that with our testing that we do. And when we're out walking the fields, we're trying to figure out what's going on, what's impacting growth. And we're trying to put together a plan to address that. And it can be often very complicated, but it's really our job to come up with a simple, clear path for the customer to take in order to achieve their goals. Mm-hmm. I never tell that to a stranger because they'd be like, what?
Yeah.
So I tell people like, oh, we're the people that look for bugs and weeds. That's what we do. We look for bugs and weeds. We go out, we walk the fields. Like, I'm out walking the fields for Jeff, whoever, and, looking for bugs and weeds and anything that's going on in the field. And then we're going to come up with a plan of action to take care of whatever we find. And usually landowners they understand that.
For the most part.
Yeah. Yeah.
I find, like, my friends too, friends and family, like, or you know, whatever, they're like, I still don't quite understand what you do. It's like, that's okay. Just believe me, I'm giving value somewhere. But no, where I find it interesting, when I find the overlap between agronomy work and driving yield and trying to help our growers, a lot of it's just understanding the basics and not overlooking the basics when you're moving forward. And I'm talking along the lines of soil amendments and managing things to grow. And I find that when you translate over into the world of wildlife management and food plots, most of those people don't have an agronomic background. And I think it is really, really easy to get marketed into purchasing something or doing something to a food plot that is just a waste of your money, or you don't realize, and this is what opened my eyes when I started a job in agronomy, is the price gap when you start talking about the same overlaying products that we put in ag fields, and it's repackaged and sold in the food plot world, and the price gap is huge. And you know, there's probably people that would listen to this that would kill me for that, but I don't care because I want to help people, and I think there's a potential there to really educate people. So first things first, in my point of view, I get asked all the time, can you come look at this food plot, whether that's just a friend of mine or maybe it's even one of our landowners. Now, ask questions about that, so I'll go look at it. And a lot of the times, it's basic things and why it's not working. But first and foremost, start off with a soil test. So simple. I mean, literally, soil tests are cheap.
Soil tests are cheap. Almost every state is going to have a land grant university, and that land grant university is going to have a testing lab. So Penn State, right? We're in Pennsylvania. Penn State has a soil testing lab. Anybody can walk into an extension office. You can buy a soil test bag for $20, and you can go out into your food plot, take a sample, fill that bag, send it to the lab, and that lab will return results to you within 2 weeks. You can put right on the package what you're growing, like I'm doing this for a food plot, and they'll return recommendations to you for limestone, for fertilizer, for nitrogen, and that way you have an unbiased recommendation of what to go off of. And almost every state is going to have a testing lab at the university that is going to be able to help people do that.
And one thing I try to tell a lot of people when they ask me questions on fertility, like, we're a third-party consultant, and we do that same thing, but more fine-tuned to the growers and what their goals are, and knowing a little bit more history. But I think that's what's important, because a lot of times what I've seen with people who plant food plots is they get a soil test through a company that they buy product from, and it's easy to then buy product or something that they don't need or misinterpret what they need from that soil test result. I think that's, to me, that's a big one, because I think it's easy to get the rug pulled over you, in a sense.
For sure. Like any company that does soil testing, whether you're a fertilizer company or a chemical company or a consultant like us, when you send your samples to the lab will ask you what kind of recommendations you want to push out. And you get to choose. You get to choose what you're going to identify as an optimal level or what you're going to identify as a deficient level. And then you get to say, okay, if phosphorus comes back deficient, this is how much I want to recommend to somebody. Mm-hmm. So the testing part of it is pretty much going to be standard. No matter what lab you send it to, feel confident that the numbers that are on that page are accurate. Nobody is interjecting their opinion into those numbers. But then as soon as you start looking at the recommendations that are coming off of that soil test, that's when you have the risk of having somebody's opinion overlaid on top of your recommendations. So that's why I would say a land grant university, they have no skin in the game as to how your food plot is doing. They're not trying to sell you anything. They're simply trying to fulfill a service of that land grant mission by doing soil tests for people. So if you send a soil test there and you get your recommendations back, feel confident that those recommendations are exactly what you need and no more. If you send your sample to someplace else and it's coming back with specific product recommendations, I think then you want to just take a step back and take an evaluation of how that recommendation is coming to you and what they're looking at. You can always go online if you're not sure that they're recommending the right thing. You can go online to Penn State or any land-grant university. You can figure out what the optimal levels of phosphorus and potassium and pH are supposed to be. And then you can look at your soil test and the recommendations that they're providing and say, okay, does that make sense? Mm-hmm. It's probably a 10-minute job for somebody to do. But I feel when I look at the recommendations that are coming down through the ag retailers, the people that are selling fertilizer to the 500-acre farmer, they're fairly well close aligned on the major nutrients.
Absolutely.
I feel like they're recommending limestone for pH about like we are. They're recommending phosphorus and potassium about like we are. You get into some of the other micronutrient things, and I think there's probably a diverging path of how we handle recommendations. But for the major things that people are going to be looking at within a soil test, I find the majority of the ag industry does a pretty good job. Now, I don't know a whole lot about what the wildlife food plot industry is doing and how they're overlaying their recommendations. But like I said, you can easily go onto a Penn State website and see what those optimal levels are supposed to be.
Well, and I think what you would expect from a wildlife side of things or a food plot side of things, there's a lot of parallels in interpretation. And what I mean by that is it's so easy to want to find a new buzzword or the new thing that's going to drive yield or make something better. And the thing that comes to my mind is, you know, we get in our winter meetings that we do. So, you know, the way it works, the year works for us. You know, we go out in after crops are harvested. We pull soil tests and we take those samples. We meet this time of year, go through those samples, what they mean, try to plug the lowest holes in the bucket on those samples and then make, you know, a field plan for that year. Then we're walking those fields and kind of laying that out. When you're talking about going through the soil tests, first of all, our soil test, when we get those results back, we do a basic soil test, which is going to include your pH, your buffer pH, your phosphorus, potassium, your CECs of the soil, your calcium, magnesium, base saturations, and organic matter. And you know, there's options to fill other stuff out, but you know, I get asked all the time, and I'm sure you have in plenty of cases too. Why aren't we testing for more in the soil? And one of the things I tell a lot of people is we need to make sure we cover the basics in those macros really, really, because I don't care what we do in the secondary and micro world, if we're missing the mark on something as simple as having our pH correct, having potassium correct, having phosphorus correct, I don't really care what we're doing beyond that because we're missing the mark, in my opinion.
Absolutely. Get the basics right. Your return on investment from the basics is so much greater than your return on investment from all the small things. If you're looking at return on investment from soil additives, right? pH and putting limestone on, it's going to give you a big return on investment. Making sure that your potassium and your phosphorus levels are right, that's going to give you a really big return on investment. Then you start to get into some of your secondary nutrients like sulfur or boron or zinc or manganese, and the return on investment just goes down so fast mm-hmm. that before you even start to think about looking at some of those smaller micronutrient things, you've really got to get the pH, the phosphorus, and the potassium, you got to get that right. In Pennsylvania, what they're going to consider an optimal range of pH is going to be anywhere from 6 to 6.5. So if somebody is doing a multi-species food plot mix that's going to have some cereals, it's going to have some forbs, it's going to have some legumes, you know, each of those species is going to have a different ideal pH. But if you can keep that pH somewhere between 6 and 6.5, those plants are going to flourish and do everything that they need to. From a phosphorus perspective, you know, phosphorus is really going to be a 30 to 50 part per million optimal range. There's zero need for you to have phosphorus levels much above 50 when it comes to a food plot. Potassium is probably the potassium and pH are probably the two most common deficiencies that we see. And from a potassium perspective, we want those potassium levels to be about 100 to 200 parts per million. If they're below 100 parts per million, you will see signs of potassium deficiency. So I usually try to keep it simple for people, and I want them to remember three numbers, right? If you want optimal pH, it's 6.5. If you want optimal phosphorus, it's 50. And if you want optimal potassium, it's 150. Mm-hmm. And until you can get all three of those numbers pretty close within your soil test, don't worry a whole lot about some of those other secondary nutrients. Once you do get pH, phosphorus, and potassium nailed down, okay. Then maybe let's start taking a look at sulfur. Let's start taking a look at some of these other things that are maybe going to influence forage quality more so than they're going to influence forage quantity. Mm-hmm. Right? We got to get the quantity thing down first, and then we can start looking at some of the other things.
Absolutely. And when we talk about product and adjusting and missing the mark, one simple thing that I see too before we get into talking about product and addressing it with amendments, I've had two circumstances happen in a lot of cases. Number one, I'll either get, why is my food plot look like crap? And I'll look at the soil test and they either don't have it or, you know, they're not managing those things that you just said. The second thing is I'll get a soil test and I'll look at it and go, wow, everything looks the way it's supposed to. So if there's experiencing something else going on, why, what exactly is going on? And it's so amazing to me how many times I go out and again, we miss the basics. Is it in a location that there's really, really poor sunlight getting to that? You know, so many times I go to places and food plots are put in the absolute worst possible places you could think. Old log landings, logging trails, dozed out paths that are narrow and don't have adequate sunshine.
Wet soils that have poor drainage.
Wet soils, log landings that have extreme compaction. That's a huge problem why we would have that, because you don't have anywhere for roots to go.
Right.
So stuff like that. So I can't not miss that, because I've been places where the soil test comes back and you go, this should grow a perfect food plot. And then you look at simple characteristics and you say, well, your food plot will do a whole lot better if you take a chainsaw and you cut down a bunch of trees on this side of your food plot, because you're going to allow more sunlight, and that's an extreme part. And that's something extremely simple but overlooked. I mean, when you're going through, and don't look at that now. When you're looking at it in February, you think, oh, I got plenty of sunlight coming through. No, the problem is going to be during the growing season.
Yeah.
It sounds simple but so overlooked. I mean, that's typically when I go to places and look at food plots, that's almost the number one thing that I have a problem addressing. It's like you need to create space not just for the plants where you're looking at it, but you need to look outside that perimeter. That's a big one.
Yeah, that's true. I think compaction, people can probably identify compaction pretty easily when they're taking a soil test. Like, I don't know about you, but like most of the food plots that I've sampled for people over the years have been like, it's either wet and has a really high water table, or it's just rocky as all get out. Mm-hmm. And in those ones that are rocky as all get out, I can't use my regular soil probe. Like when we go out and do soil testing for our customers, we have this aluminum soil probe that you push in 6 to 8 inches, and you do that 15 times throughout the field, and it's super handy. There's no rocks or very minimal rocks in an ag field. Then you go into the food plot and you can't get your soil probe in an inch and a half because it's all rock.
Exactly.
And so then I just use a shovel, right? I always have like a 4-foot shovel in my truck that I can use for soil tests. And when I'm getting a soil test in a food plot, oftentimes what I do is I'll dig a hole 8 inches deep with my shovel. And then once I get that hole dug 8 inches deep and I have a clean face along the back side of the hole, I'm going to move my shovel back about an inch. And then I'm going to drive it down as hard as I can and get a clean cut so that I basically have an inch of soil the length of my shovel face.
Right.
And I'm going to take that, put it in a bucket, and I'm going to go around the food plot maybe three other times and get, you know, four holes dug, four faces, put it in a bucket, mix it all together, and then I've got my sample. Mm. But they can identify compaction when they're doing that, because if you're going to have compaction in the soil, you're going to have a difficult time digging down, right? If my shovel face is 12 inches, I'm going to struggle to get down 3-4 inches if I have compaction. And that's probably what you're talking about with those landings.
Oh, absolutely.
How deep do you need to go before you hit that compaction level?
And sometimes pretty darn deep when you're talking about running skidders and, you know, log trucks on places like that. Sometimes it's extreme and you've got to keep in mind or try to keep realistic. I mean, I think people think that it's going to be overnight work in some of these places when you're talking about deciduous forest. And I've pulled soil tests that have pHs under a 5. And that's going to take a significant amount of time just to get the pH to a level of optimum. That's not just a one-year fix.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So getting back to the pH side of things, the P, the K, and managing those macros and the low hole in the bucket, so to speak. I get asked all the time, what do you think about this product or this product or this product? We already addressed that in a soil test. If you get a recommendation from a grant, you know, let's say it comes back with a 2-ton per acre application recommendation of lime, or maybe it's going to come back with a 200-pound per acre application of potash. First of all, I tell people all the time, because most times food plots are small, how many square feet are in a food are in 1 acre? And a lot of time people tell me, I have an acre food plot, and you look at it like, this might be a quarter to a half in that range. I do that all the time. So first of all, 43,570 square feet is 1 acre.
You
so that is the number to keep in mind when people want to figure out how much product you need to put on the field. That's a big one. But second of all, we're talking about a pretty substantial amount. You know, 1 ton, 2,000 pounds of lime on 1 acre. That's a lot of material to move. So people, you know, most food plotters are talking about doing something with, you know, hand equipment, ATV, maybe with a drag spreader. So then you get products like like something you'd throw on your lawn. Maybe you're talking about a liquid lime in a sense, and people go, well, this says it does the exact same thing. And it's the interpretation, and I'd kind of like you to talk about that. I've talked about this a little bit, but I mean, it's kind of the difference in my mind between a plant amendment for that year and a soil amendment.
Yeah. So let's talk about pH, for instance, right? So pH is a logarithmic scale. So a pH of 6 is like 10 times lower than a pH of 7. Mm-hmm. And a pH of 5 is 100 times lower than a pH of 7. So logarithmic scale. So pH is very much sensitive to that swing. So when you get pHs in your soil that are down much below 5.8, and pH, is just a measurement of hydrogen, and it's a measurement of aluminum in the soil. Yep. At least in the mid-Atlantic region, that's what pH is measuring. Hydrogen and aluminum, right? And not just aluminum, but free-floating aluminum. So when you get pHs that are down below 5.8, you have a lot of hydrogen present in the soil, and you have a lot of aluminum that's not attached to something, just kind of floating around the soil. And it just eats roots away. Roots can't survive with that much hydrogen in the soil. They can't survive with that much free-floating aluminum. So when you put lime on, right, that reaction is you're putting lime, which is calcium carbonate, and the calcium dissociates from the carbonate, and the carbonate, which is CO3, right, one of those oxygens is going to pop off of that, and it's going to latch onto two hydrogens and create water. Mm-hmm. And so now you're left with water and carbon dioxide and some extra calcium. And so the pH rectification goes through that carbonate molecule. So you can get calcium carbonate, you can get magnesium carbonate. Those are probably going to be the two most common ones. If I were talking to somebody about, you know, what kind of product to use to rectify pH, I would probably lean towards doing like a pelletized lime.
Right.
Pelletized lime comes in 50-pound bags. You can get it in calcium carbonate. You can get it in magnesium carbonate. Easy to handle. You can put it in a toe spreader. You can just throw it around with your hand. Pretty easy to manage, right? That's what I use for my yard. It's what I use for my orchard. Pelletized lime works great. A little bit on the expensive side, but like I said, worth the investment. The liquid limes, I've used the liquid lime on my yard one time, and I had to order it. It took forever for it to come in. I had to drive like an hour to a truck stop to pick it up from somebody, and I brought it back. I was super excited. I got liquid lime, and it clogged up my sprayer like nothing else. It clogged up my sprayer within 3 minutes. My pump got clogged up. My nozzle got clogged up. I was trying to use just the spray wand. I have a 10-foot boom on my sprayer, but I knew the nozzles on my boom were going to be too too fine. There was no way I was going to get liquid lime through the nozzles on my boom. So I thought, okay, I'm just going to use the wand sprayer on the tank. And like I said, within 3 minutes, I had a clogged pump. I had my wand got clogged up, and then I ended up having to buy a whole new pump. Mm-hmm. And I had to replace my wand. I had to replace my filters. It was awful, awful. So I would caution people, like, if you have low pH, which would be pretty common for somebody with a food plot on a mountainside to have a low pH, just given the nature of that, I would lean towards doing a pelletized lime. I think it's going to be an easier product for people to handle, because I just don't want people to go through that experience of having to buy a whole new pump and clean out all their stuff. It was nasty. So, you know, once they get that limestone put on, right, don't expect immediate changes. You're looking at a mineral that you're applying to the soil in order to achieve a chemical reaction. And so you're going to apply lime in April. And if that limestone reacts by August, you're going to be pretty happy about
Absolutely.
That. Like, it just takes forever. Mm-hmm. What I usually tell my customers is, hey, you've got a pH of 5.5. And in order to take that pH from a 5.5 to like a 6.5, it's going to take like 3 tons of lime per acre. But in the first 6 months, the amount of limestone that reacts is very small, mm-hmm. right? Most of your reaction is going to occur in that 6 to 18 month period following application. So just keep that in mind. Like, when people have food plots, if their pH is low and they're trying to figure out how much lime to put on what you can this year. And then knowing that it's going to take 6 to 12 months in order for you to start seeing that reaction, and then maybe soil test it again and see what the pH is, and then you can kind of apply lime over a period of years in order to get that pH to where you want to. You don't have to do it all at once.
Exactly. And a couple of years ago, I was at an event. It was a food plot event, and one of Lebanon County's finest extension agronomists was there, Del Void. I'll name him
for guy.
This.
Yeah, he's
good
been
guy
doing it forever.
Yeah, he has, and he was one of the speakers there, and he was talking about a couple things, and, you know, me being me, I had to stir the pot in a sense, because I love doing that, and I asked him, because I knew he would give a great answer, and I said to him, Del, can you just, when you were talking about the basics in the soil test for this food plot parameter project that you were doing, that you just presented to us, I said, can you explain to everybody listening here the difference between the liquid lime and running a bulk product? Because, you know, liquid lime, I don't want to talk negatively that it's a bad thing. It's not. You know, it has its place. There's products out there that have a lot better efficacy to prevent the problems that you experienced.
it was awful.
Yeah, that's bad. But there's products out there to prevent that from happening. But he put it in such a simple way of thinking. He said, think about it. You're getting a recommendation for 2 tons of material. He said, and that lime might have a CCE of 80, 90, 90 plus percent, which is
right, so CCE, calcium carbonate equivalent.
Yes.
Yeah. So that is the percentage of the material, like comparing it to raw limestone. Like, if pure limestone was 100%, it'd be 100 CCE. Calcium carbonate equivalent, a lot of materials are, what, 80 to 90%?
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So still, you're talking about a lot of product to make major changes within the profile of the soil. And he said, think about that, and then think about putting liquid lime on in the sense of the 5-gallon jug that you get for that food plot. He goes, yeah, you're making changes to the soil, but it's minuscule.
Yeah.
It's minuscule. It's so short-term
small.
Thinking.
Right.
And, you know, a lot of people will make that argument in the food plot world that, well, you've got this section way back on your property. It's hard to get to. This is an easy solution. And maybe it is in certain cases. Maybe that's going to be easier to do on an annual basis to maintain. But you get to a point where if you're doing this for 10 years straight, to me, managing it the first 2 to 3 years, you're set for a long time in food plot cases most of the time.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. pH is not going to go, it's not going to go up and down fast. If I took a soil test today and the soil pH was a 6.5 and I came back next February and took a soil test in the same spot, my soil test might be a 6.4, right? It goes down very slowly through time. That it's not like, you know, you spent a couple of years getting your pH up to a 6.5, and now you're going to wait another 3 years before you soil test. And in that three-year period, your soil test isn't going to go from a 6.5 to a 5.5.
Exactly.
It's maybe going to go from a 6.5 to a 6.2, maybe a 6.3, right? It's very slow decline as that acidification process occurs. Once you get that initial investment done in pH, you should be set for a pretty long time.
Absolutely, because a lot of the time, the things that reduce our pH over time, like when I'm thinking like from agronomically in our corn, bean, wheat rotations, the things we do on an annual basis kind of make that process go quicker. That's probably the easiest way to put it. Versus a food plot where a lot of the time when you get your basic stuff that we're talking about managed, you get stuff into optimum levels, you're not doing a ton of tillage. I talk constantly about how to do no-till food plots with minimal equipment, stuff like that, and the benefits to that and how that equates to hopefully a better quality food plot and better hunting and yada, yada, yada. Like the process of throwing seed and managing weeds, we don't have a very, very fast process of acidification.
No, we don't. Most of your acidification is coming from your parent material, right? It's coming from the rocks at the bottom of your soil. And so people are going to put lime on the top of their soil profile. And if their pH is super low, like you need to do the tillage and incorporate that limestone through your whole soil profile. And I'm a huge proponent of no-till, love no-till production. But if you surface apply your lime, you know, it's only going to leach down through the soil profile at about an inch a year. So if your roots, right, you're going to go out and you're going to plant a multi-species mix, and it's going to be some clover and it's going to be some sorghum and buckwheat and whatever else you're thinking, and those roots are going down, you know, 24, 36 inches, and you know, how really, what is your options for affecting that soil pH through the whole root profile? It's fairly limited. So if you have a low pH to start, you're probably going to need to do the tillage and incorporate that limestone as deep into the soil profile as you possibly can, because if you surface apply it, it's only going to leach down at an inch a year, right? So now you've got a pH of 5.3 at 12 inches, and you surface apply your lime in a no-till situation, and it's literally going to take 10 years for the limestone to get all the way down to that 12-inch mark to have an effect on pH.
Right.
So if people have super low pHs, I hate to say it, but do the tillage. Get that limestone down as deep as you can, affect as much of the soil profile as you possibly can, and then once you get the pH out of that danger zone, then let's talk about doing a no-till system and just kind of letting that limestone leach down through at its natural level.
Yeah, so we've been talking a lot about soil tests, and that's the stuff I wanted to talk about. So if people are listening to this, you're still hanging on with this, then that means you're really interested into this nerdy stuff, because
who doesn't
it's important.
Love pH?
Exactly. It was funny because you spoke at an event 2 weeks ago or a week ago, and I'll shout out to PA Plotters, who's probably listening to this right now. He sent this post about this presentation he went to, and I was looking at his post, and I'm like, well, that was the place that my boss was speaking at. And I scroll through his pictures. Yeah, there's my boss and his presentation. It was kind of funny. So it was really cool to see that Mike was going, and he was really interested from an agronomic perspective, soil health. And I think that's a big stuff. Soil health in the world of whitetails and wildlife management, I feel like has become a little bit of a buzzword in some senses. Not that it is a buzzword, but I feel like a lot of people are harping on it so much and missing the mark of why we do it in the first place. And it's the reason that I do it is for A, the system that I like to use makes my life simpler. When I'm looking at the amount of food plot acres that I plant on an annual basis, if I can avoid having to take a tractor or a four-wheeler with a disc and be disking constantly, that makes my life a whole lot simpler. But the aspect of the soil health, the way nutrients work through your soil and the way the plant interactions are occurring in the soil, the less we disturb that from a food plot sense, why would we? Especially from a wildlife perspective. To me, it just makes sense, but it's really hard to communicate how a simple system like that really benefits you over time. Because I think people get so hung up on, I need to have the absolute most attractive plants, and I got to exchange the most nutrients through the plants to better the fawn production and milk production in deer and inches and antlers on whitetail. And that's great if that's your goal, but you know, this is probably a statement for another podcast, but I don't really care the quality of milk production and the antler growth that you experience on all your deer if you are doing your hunting strategy wrong and you're chasing them to get shot on your neighbor's property anyway. And that's a whole other topic of discussion.
But so you guys have, you've done a lot of food plots at your place over the years. You know, it's mountain ground, it's rugged territory. How much time did you have to invest in getting your soil right so that you could look at some of these soil health issues?
Well, to be honest with you, the amount of work that would have been done to get the pH just in check, like we were talking about, that some of the first fields were really, really small. And I remember we used to take the old dump truck, fill it with ag lime, and shovel it. And it was like your forearms would be
like Popeye.
Oh yeah, like Popeye when you were done. And you know, not that we need to bore everybody this, but ag lime is one of the things that breaks down the slowest when you compare it to pelletizer or something like that. I remember we shoveled it on, and it took a very, very long time for that to break down. Years. We did tillage and stuff like that, but the soil health component of it. You know, we didn't really start to pay attention to that until I probably started paying attention to it from an agronomic perspective. So within the past 5 to 7 years, as I was going through my education and stuff like that and translating some of that. So how that needle has moved over time, it's been very, very small. But the benefit that I like is, number one, the ground that I work with is thin topsoil in the first place. Why would I want to till it in the first place?
Right.
Because it doesn't take much for it to run off if we leave that bare. I mean, yeah. I remember dozing out locations and getting 5-inch rains, and those 5-inch rains or whatever ridiculous summer rains we got. I mean, you just see piles of topsoil at the bottom. Huh? There goes what you had. So holding soil is what's most important to me. But we talked about, you know, a lot of these just basic macronutrients. I don't really care how much you do in that sense. If you don't get rain, it doesn't grow. And if you can't hold the rain, that's important. It sounds so simple, but I'm saying these simple things because these are the conversations I have constantly. When I get questions about this liquid fertilizer to put on for the plants, and if it's got molybdenum and zinc and boron and all this, those are all really, really important things, and I'm not discrediting those because from an agronomic perspective, we see a lot of micronutrient deficiencies.
Plants need them, 18 essential nutrients.
Exactly.
But if you're going to grow a sorghum plot for deer, right? It's going to take, 100 pounds of nitrogen. It's going to remove 60 pounds of phosphorus. It's going to take 100 pounds of potassium, and it's going to take 1/4 pound of zinc, right? And all those micronutrients, you know, zinc, boron, molybdenum, manganese, right? You name your micronutrient, like the difference in need is so great, right? It's literally like 100 pounds of potassium that crop needs versus 1/4 pound of copper.
Mm-hmm.
And it's night and day. You know,
yeah.
You just don't need much of those micronutrients. But when you buy it in a jug, like one of the most profitable things that a chemical or a fertilizer company can do is sell you that jug, right? And it's got 0.01% copper and 0.02% boron. And it is a very profitable product for them to sell. May not be benefiting you all that much, but it's great for them.
Well, and one thing that I've learned, one statement I've learned in our travels and our job is if you put anything into a depleted system, you will see a response. So the example I'll give is there's a new food plot I can think of, and the pH, I believe, when it started was like a 4.9. The phosphorus was less than 10 parts per million. We already said 30 to 50 optimum. The potassium was probably 40 parts per million. Optimum's, you know, 130 plus.
Right.
So extremely depleted system. You know, it called for a lot of lime, called for fertilizer, and we did some of those things, but the breakdown and where that soil is in that virgin state is very, very poor. that same year, one of my buddies bought, I'm not going to name the product, but it was a very, very well-known liquid fertilizer product to get your food plot up and running, and sprayed it in a couple of locations. And we put a couple check strips out and put fences up. And you could see a major, major difference in those cases. And it was like, wow, look at this. We need to run this on more places. And my point, and why I was such a negative Nancy about that, is, yeah, it did it for a short-term solution. And maybe that's something that I should consider if I really want to try to maximize as much as possible. Maybe something on a really, really poor startup situation, that's a benefit if you're trying to get forage in the fall. But from a soil management and a long-term management, and I'm always thinking with what we do, I'm always thinking long-term, you're not going to see that exact same major response when you get the basics right. And that's the thing I try to stress all the time.
Right. Yeah. Even if you look at products, you know, you're going to go to your local Agway or your local store, and you're going to get a bag of 10-20-20, right? Or a bag of 5-15-40 or whatever fertilizer analysis you're going to buy, right? It's a 50-pound bag. It's 10-20-20, right? So that means it's 10% nitrogen, 20% phosphorus, 20% potassium. So out of that 50 pounds, you have 5 pounds of nitrogen, 10 pounds of phosphorus, 10 pounds of potassium in that 50-pound jug or in that 50-pound bag, right? So now you compare that to a 2.5-gallon jug of liquid fertilizer. And a 2.5-gallon jug of liquid fertilizer, you know, it probably weighs 10, 11 pounds a gallon. Mm-hmm. So now 2.5 gallons, you've got, let's just say 30 pounds of fertilizer or 30 pounds of material in that jug. And it's 10% nitrogen or it's 8% nitrogen. Right. Well, now you got 3 pounds of, you know, nitrogen in that whole jug. Mm-hmm. Right. So the people should really think about that and compare and contrast the products. When you have a soil test that's really low, go to the dry products. You just get so much higher concentration of nutrients in those dry products. And, you know, put those 50-pound bags over your shoulder and hoof them into the food plot and sprinkle them around, because that's going to give you your biggest response and your biggest bang for your buck.
Exactly. And I think people get sticker shock from that, because soil amendments and stuff like that, when you're talking about it in any size, whether you're talking a half-acre food plot or you're talking, you know, 10, 20 acres of food plots, it's an investment. And, you know, most of the time what I've learned is people who love their deer, they're not afraid to spend money. But at the same time, we're in a corner of the world where Pennsylvania Dutchmen like to cut corners where they can and see something cheaper, and it's going to, quote unquote, supply the same thing. Mm-hmm. It's long-term versus short-term thinking is what I try to communicate so hard. And you know, it's all a matter of how you want to interpret it, what's going to be the best situation for you. But like I said, really reaping the rewards of fertility, soil health long-term, and what you're trying to do with a food plot, which my goal all the time is just to create an opening of attraction that's going to steer deer movement in a direction that's going to be favorable to me. You know, I don't want to put a food plot in a location that's not going to be favorable to me. And any added benefit from a nutrition standpoint is great. But when you're talking about making 1% of a property food plots, you're really doing a negligible amount to the overall nutrition. Not that it's bad, but I think a lot of hunters and people who look at it from their back 40 or less than that, the impact you're having on the herd is insignificant when you're talking from a nutrient standpoint. You have a bigger impact when you talk the hunting strategy thing, which, like I said, it's another topic we've talked many, many times. And when you can put all the places together that you can keep deer from seeing you, hearing you, smelling you, you don't expose them to pressure outside of your borders. And that's what's important to me. So I kind of went on a hunting tangent there. But I mean, like I said, when we're talking about fertilizer and stuff, it gets boring, but this is why we talk about it.
No, it is like, and the other thing I would point out is, depending on when the last time you took a soil test is, if you haven't taken a soil test in the last couple of years, go do it this spring. Yeah. But if your soil tests are pretty poor, it's going to influence the species that are going to survive in that food plot. Mm-hmm. Right. So if you're not sure what your soil tests are, you're going to be better served by getting a multi-species mix and putting it out there. The ones that are tolerant to a low pH, the ones that can really, you know, are scrappy and can survive low potassium situations, they're going to thrive. And the species that can't will die off. Once you get your levels up to where they are, more species should be surviving. Mm-hmm. So like things that are not going to do well in low pHs. A lot of your clovers aren't going to do well in low pHs. A lot of the more fancier species that you want to try to promote aren't going to do well in low pH. They're not going to do well in low potassium. You're going to be stuck growing buckwheat in some of those situations. So definitely get those levels up as fast as you possibly can. You know, go buy the bags of pelletized lime. Go buy the bags of 10-20-20. Get it done, because you can get it done pretty quickly.
Absolutely. One thing's kind of the last thing when we're thinking about, because I'm kind of running out of things to talk about from the end of the soil test. I mean, we kind of talked about just the concept of bulk product and making sure you're treating it as an amendment versus, you know, the one thing that you don't have on a soil test unless you specifically ask for it is nitrogen levels. You know, we talk about our macronutrients, it's N, P, and K, nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium. And nitrogen isn't on a soil test unless you ask for it, because it's a very mobile nutrient. So a lot of the time what I handle for people is just putting straight urea on after it's planted or at planting, depending on the on the crop. You know, we get into situations of putting for you know, a small overwintering forage, maybe that's like a small grain silage with wheat and triticale and stuff like that, and you're trying to really drive yield. You know, we'll get into those 100 to 130 pounds of total nitrogen that we're putting on it. And most of the time, what I've experienced in a system where we've kind of maintained our pH, our P, and our K, and we're doing everything we can from soil health perspective that we're going to talk about in later episodes here, is you know, putting somewhere between 75 and 100 pounds per acre of urea on is going to give you about 30 to 45 pounds of actual nitrogen. And for the all intents and purposes of what you want to see, that's plenty in most cases.
Oh yeah, yeah. So I have like a 16 tree orchard down here on my property, which I have to have fences around because the deer come in and just destroy. Like, I think if you ever wanted to put a great food plot up, just go plant a bunch of apple trees and they will come in and just destroy those apple trees within 30 days. But I go to the local Agway out here in Ephrata, and they have bags of stabilized urea, right? Mm-hmm. So urea is really susceptible to loss, right? If you surface apply your urea, a lot of that urea volatilizes within a couple of days if you don't incorporate it. And at the this location, I can get stabilized urea, so it doesn't volatilize. So I'll go out in the spring and I'll get a 50-pound bag of stabilized urea, a 50-pound bag of 10-20-20, and like 3 or 4 bags of pelletized lime. And that's my spring program for my orchard down here. Go and just spread the pelletized lime by hand. I don't do anything fancy. Same way with the 10-20-20, I spread that by hand. And then when it comes to the urea, you know, stabilized product, I can go and I can just sprinkle that around the tree line of each individual tree and use that as my nitrogen source. But it works out great, and you definitely see a response to it. It's not it's not a huge investment that you have. I mean, sometimes it depends on the cost of fertilizer, but I would say that I get all that stuff for $100-$120 probably.
Mm-hmm.
Which, hey, you know, 16 fruit trees, if they ever get big enough to produce fruit, I'm going to be, you know, raking in the money.
Yeah, I'll be coming down for apples and apples and stuff all the time.
I say that extremely sarcastically, because after about 4 or 5 years of growing fruit trees, I've picked 2 apples and 4 blueberries. And I've replaced like 3 or 4 apple trees, because deer just keep eating them if I don't fence them in.
Yeah, that's a big problem.
Yeah.
Major problem. Major problem. Well, hey, we've been yakking for soil for about soil tests and trying to manage stuff for quite a long time, and I think at this point it's probably worth considering wrapping up. Eric, am I thinking about anything? Am I missing anything when you're talking about the basics when it's coming to just growing a sufficient food plot based on a soil test? Am I missing anything that people really need to think about?
No, the thing that I would just want to drive home to people is when you do that soil test, right? And we want to do it like every 2 or 3 years, right? Mm-hmm. You're going to go out and you get a soil test. We got to get that soil test down about 6 to 8 inches. So you're going to use your shovel and you're going to dig a hole, create that face, you know, and grab that 1 inch of soil with a new shovel face, put that in a bucket, do it 3 or 4 times, mix it all up. And then you're going to have like a baseball size amount of dirt that you're going to put in a bag and send that to the lab. Just do it, mm-hmm. right? It'll take you 15 or 20 minutes to do that soil test. It's not a big it's not a big job, but it's so important for creating that foundation of how that food plot is going to work for you.
Absolutely. So
go do it, you know, send your kids out to do it, make it a fun time, tell them there's a treasure hidden at the bottom of the hole, but just whatever it takes, go and get that soil test done. Send it out to the lab, you know, me personally, if I was advising landowners on their food plots, I would send them over to Penn State Extension, grab the bags, everything, all the results are going to come right back to you. They can email it to you. They can mail it to you, whatever you desire. But it's a fairly easy process. Then once you get those results back, act quickly, you know, don't beat around the bush and a little bit of this, a little bit of that. Hit that pH with lime as hard as you need to, understanding that it could take a year to 3 years in order to get that pH up to the optimal level where people need it to, and get those phosphorus and potassium levels up where they need it to. Go and buy a bag of fertilizer, put it on. The response from fertilizer should be pretty immediate. If you apply fertilizer in April, that material will be available to your food plot in April. It doesn't take any time for it to release. It's immediately available. So you should notice a response to fertilizer immediately. The limestone's going to take a little bit longer, but go out and get it done.
Well, speaking of fertilizer response, you brought up a good point. So when you get stuff into optimum, your phosphorus, your potassium, calcium levels. Phosphorus and calcium are the two that are always talked about because those are two that are very important nutrients when it comes to developing bone and developing young fawns. And I think people have this misunderstanding of how much you actually need, and this concept that if optimum is good, a little bit more is better. And that's not always the case. Can you explain that?
Yeah, so it is not a free pathway into the plant. If I am calcium and I am phosphorus, it is not just an open door into the plant to get into that plant, right? A plant has a highly regulated system for uptaking nutrients, and you can almost think about it as like the regulation process is like your house, right? The only way that people can get into your house is through the door, and you get to control how far that door opens and if it opens at all. And so nutrient uptake is exactly the same way, right? The plant knows how much phosphorus it needs. It knows how much calcium it needs to take in order to have that correct ratio of phosphorus and calcium. And so there's a different door for phosphorus to come in, and there's a different door for calcium to come in. And the plant is actively regulating how far and how quickly those doors open in order to let phosphorus and calcium and really any other nutrient in. So, you know, when you think about what an optimal level is, and if an optimal level is 30 to 50 parts per million, and somebody is saying, well, optimal phosphorus, 30 to 50 parts per million, my, if I increase my phosphorus to 200 parts per million, won't I have just a so much healthier forage and get better bone mass? No, you won't.
No, you just have a lot of phosphorus.
You just have a lot of phosphorus because a plant only needs so much, and it has a highly active regulation process to regulate how much of that phosphorus gets into the plant. So really all you need to do is just meet those basic thresholds of being in an optimal range. Once you get into the optimal range, the plant's going to take care of the rest. It's going to use its regulatory processes, and it's going to be able to allow that phosphorus to come in, allow that calcium to come in, and do what you want it to from forage quality. You know, in some cases, once you get to that point where your levels are optimal, it may be cover crop species selection that matter more than what that actual fertility is.
Absolutely. Well, hey, before we go, I want you. There's one story I got to hear.
Oh gosh.
So, one of the first times I met you, my father-in-law was telling me stories about when you were young and you shot this giant buck, and you told the story of driving up to it and where your dad. And I always butcher it. So I got to hear the biggest buck in all.
Right. So when I was 12 years old, you know, so I went and I got my hunting license at 12 years old, and buck season is coming up. You know, it starts the Monday after Thanksgiving, and this was like 1990, whatever. And wouldn't you know it, like that October, I was in wood shop, and I cut my finger off in wood shop. I didn't get to hunt when I was 12 years old. So anyway, now I'm 13, and my dad says, he goes, well, we're going to build you a tree stand. So he builds me a tree stand in our pasture. And I said, well, where are you going to be, Dad? And he's like, well, I'm going to be over on the other side of the woods. So the first day a buck comes along, and you know, it's a a misty, like it's raining a little bit, you know, like the fog is in the air, and he takes me out to the stand, and he, you know, I climb up the tree, I sit in my stand, and we call this tree stand the Taj Mahal, because it was like as big as a conference table, right? Like you, me, and like our kids could have sat in this tree stand, it was so big. So I'm in the Taj Mahal and I'm sitting, and my dad is maybe 200 yards up the hill in his tree stand, probably just thankful that he had a break from me.
Right. Mentoring like you're supposed to.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah. From distance, from afar. Mentoring from afar. So I had to borrow a gun from a neighbor when I was 13 years old. I didn't have a deer rifle. So I borrowed a gun from my neighbor, and it was a 308. And the guy that I borrowed it from was just, he was like a hunting nut. Like he was into hunting. And I would go over to his house, and he taught me how to reload. And when I'm, you know, 13 years old, and he's like, all right, you know, your dad asked if you could borrow a gun from me, come on down and come pick Mike. Well, I go down into his house, and his whole basement is like a vault, and there are just guns like the whole wall. And I'm amazed. I didn't realize one person could have that many guns.
America.
Right. Yeah. America. So he takes me over to the wall, and he pulls out this 308, and he's like, "Wow, I call this one my sniper rifle, and it's got, you know, the stock is all adjusted that you can adjust it for your cheek, and it's got this giant scope on it." And for somebody who's 13 year old, like, I really thought I was using a sniper rifle. So he takes me out and he teaches me how to shoot this 308. So anyway, that's what I'm walking out into the woods with that morning, and my dad, you know, parks me in the Taj Mahal, and he walks up to sit in his stand. And he, the last thing he says to me, he's like, look, just shoot the first thing that comes along. The first thing that comes along, you just shoot it. He goes, I don't care what it is. Cause we grew up on a farm. We had farm tags, you know, so doe, buck really didn't matter to him. We were going to use the Cheerios box as our tag and report it to the game commission, and you know, everything was going to be okay. So daylight comes, and like the sun comes up, and it's just barely bright enough that you can see. And here comes this doe, you know, walking down from my dad, like it had to go past him, came walking down towards me, and it's 20 yards away. And I'm like, oh my gosh, here it is. It's brown. Like, I'm going to shoot it. So I put my gun up, and I'm like, no, I'm going to wait. I'm going to wait and see what happens. Like, it's too early in the morning to shoot this thing. So a couple minutes pass, and the doe walks down farther in the pasture, and I kind of lose interest, and I'm looking around. And the next thing I know, I look back towards where the doe is, and here she comes. She's walking back towards me, and there's this monster buck, like, just right behind her. And he's just trailing, you know, 6 feet along behind her, and she's leading him right back up the trail. And by this time, you know, it's fully light in the morning, and this buck comes within 20 yards of me, 20 yards away. I'm 13 years old. I'm literally wearing street clothes. I've done nothing to mask my scent. I'm probably jumping up and down in the stand at this point. Like I'm not being quiet. I'm not being still. I'm not doing anything, but he's following that doe, and he could care less what I'm doing. So he gets within 20 yards and I shoot. And then he runs out into a cornfield, because the corner of the pasture was at where I was sitting, was right on the edge of a cornfield. So he jumps the pasture fence and he runs out in a cornfield 40 yards. And I'm like frantically trying to like reload and get another shot. And I throw the gun up and I shoot, and the thing falls over. Well, there was only ever one hole in that deer. So when it fell over, my bullet passed right over top of it. So my dad comes down and he's like, did you shoot? I'm like, well, yeah, I shot. did you get it? And I look at him, I'm like, yeah, don't you see the rack sticking up above the corn? Because like the corn stalks are, you know, 2 feet tall or whatever. Yeah. And the rack is sticking up above the corn stalks. It was that big. So it turned out it was like a 25 or 27 inch spread 7-point. It was the biggest buck I've ever shot in my life. And I shot it by like 8 o'clock in the morning or whatever.
That's just the way you want it. Just the way you want it. Yeah, my father-in-law told me that story, that like you guys were going up and be like, don't you see it, Dad? No, where is it? Yeah, it's sticking up above the corn.
Sticking
stalks.
Up above the corn. And he's like, what?
What the heck did you just shoot for your first deer?
Yeah.
I love that story. Yeah. The first time I heard that.
So the neighbor came down, whose gun I use, and he was ecstatic. And he's like, we got to take this to the butcher. We got to get it mounted. We got to go. But yeah, I have not shot another deer that big since. I don't even think I've seen many deer that big since.
No, it's a special thing for me when you can experience something. I mean, I've been pretty blessed to be part of some really, really cool buck harvests and some mature buck over the years, but it's usually few and far between in most cases, and unless you're doing some crazy stuff. But you used to shoot a lot of competition archery too.
I did, yeah. You loved shooting archery. I got into archery when I was in college, and it was just a way to not get in trouble.
Oh, absolutely. Because yeah. It was funny, like the first time when we were, you know, when I first started working, you know, we were making conversation, getting to know each other and stuff, and started talking about archery because you knew I liked archery hunt. And I started talking like really, really basic, like, oh, this is what I'm doing with my bow and this is why I'm doing it. You're like, oh, yeah, I used to shoot that. I'm like, oh, you shot bow. And you start going into like the depths of your shooting. I'm like, oh, you shot in college. You know, that's pretty mm-hmm. cool. And then you're like, yeah, you know, I was a statewide champion or whatever. I'm like,
yeah.
What? He's like, yeah, Larry Wise used to coach. I'm like, hold on a second. Who the hell am I working for now? I'm like, what is going on? You start going in and tell me the stories about getting coached by Larry Wise, which for those of you, most people listening to this probably know who Larry Wise is, but you know, he's like the guy who wrote the book on back tension releases and back tension form and archery, which is, you know, huge in the world of competition archery.
Yep. So it was everything happens by luck and by dumb circumstance, right? So I go to Penn State and we're just a bunch of dudes shooting at targets and, mm-hmm. and having a good time. And this one woman walks in and she's like, "Are you guys the archery club?" And we're like, "Yeah, we are." She goes, "Oh, I was expecting more." And she introduces herself, and her name was Carrie, and she was like national champion of archery from Texas, right? Mm-hmm. She was at Penn State doing her master's degree. And she goes, "Have you guys ever thought about doing tournaments?" And we're like, "No, but if we get to travel, we are in."
Yeah.
So she's like, "Great, we're going to do tournaments. We're going to start shooting tournaments." So we ended up shooting all these indoor tournaments throughout Pennsylvania. And, you know, we got on like the indoor circuit of going around all the different clubs, and we end up doing the state championship. And so we go down to the state championship, and by that time, right, this is all in one season. By that time, we actually decided we should go and get Penn State shirts and all wear our Penn State shirts together. So we go to the championship, and that's the one I ended up winning. Mm-hmm. And then somebody said to us, "Hey, why don't you guys go down to the shoot in Atlantic City?" And we're like, "What?" We have no idea about the shoot in Atlantic City, but Atlantic City has a big archery shoot, mm-hmm. at least, and you get to shoot, you know, 40, 50, 60 meters indoors. And so we go down to Atlantic City, and we walk in with our Penn State shirts, and there's this guy in shooting crossbows, and he's like, "You guys are from Penn State?" And we're like, "Yeah, shirts. Penn State. We're from Penn State." He goes, "Yeah, I'm a professor at Penn State. I'll be your advisor." And the guy's name was Stan. So Stan was, he was a professor of plant physiology. Mm. And so he became our advisor. And so after that Atlantic City trip, he goes, "When do you guys meet?" And we were like, "We meet Tuesdays and Thursdays down in the White Building." He's like, "Great, I'm coming down Tuesdays." So he showed up Tuesday night. And again, like, he walks in and he goes, "This is what you guys do?" Yeah, this is what we do. He's, "How did you make it to Atlantic City doing what you're doing?" "I don't know. It was just dumb luck." He goes, "I'm going to call Larry Wise." And we're like, "Great. We have no idea who Larry Wise is." So he called Larry Wise on like that night. And Larry Wise showed up at our practice on Thursday.
Wow.
And Larry lived, you know, 40 minutes outside of State College. And he goes, "Oh," he goes, "you guys are, you know, you're going to shoot competitively. I can help you with this." He goes, "I'm going to show up once or twice a month. We're going to give you lessons, things to work on." And over that, you know, over that, between that year and the next year, Larry really did. Like, he, between him and Stan, they would come to our practices. They would give us tips. They would give us pointers. I learned how to shoot the back tension release through, you know, through him, and it's just an amazing experience, but all through dumb luck.
that's hysterical. Cause it was funny. Cause like, we're talking about shooting and like, I haven't done a lot of target archery just because of time and stuff. And, you know, I was always focused on hunting, but I took a lot of target archery concepts and I used to shoot indoor, you know, shooting three spot at 20 yards just because that, to me, that is such a fantastic way to better yourself as an archer. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when being able to shoot, you know, a quarter consistently at, you know, 60 shots to shoot a 600. And I think, like, the best I ever did on a half round at 300 was, like, a 298. And I was like, oh, man, that's really good. And we start talking, you're like, oh, yeah, I've cleared cards and stuff. I'm like, who the heck is this guy?
So when I was learning from Larry and it really in my most competitive state, I would use the back tension release in the tree stand.
Yeah.
You know, just shoot deer with the back tension release. You know, it'd be rifle season. I would just take my bow out and shoot, and, you know, no problems. I never had a problem shooting a deer with a back tension release. Now I couldn't even imagine doing it.
Well, yeah. When you're so far, you know, removed from it, like, I actually shoot a hinge release now to hunt too, just because what I've learned with myself is when I get under pressure and get excited, the only thing that I have a remote possibility of, like, having a little bit of control is with that release. And it's not like that release does so much more for me. It's just the fact that it's a mental thing that allows me to execute my shot better, because I've tried, you know, I've shot for, you know, all off season and shoot my hinge release and then go into shooting an index caliper release, and it's like a deer comes in front of me and I forget what I'm doing and I just get so dang excited and, you know, forget my shot process, punch the trigger and, you know, wound something or miss or something stupid like that. So I've kind of resulted the past few years, I've been shooting my hinge release for hunting, and I've really liked it for the most part. I've actually considered maybe trying to go back again and shoot my index release, just because I'm always tinkering with stuff. Not like I used to, because time is of the essence. You know exactly what that's like, because we we talk about that all the time. And, you know, you're somebody that I've looked up to in a lot of sense, because you talk about priorities. And you said to me one time, you were like, you know, I love all that stuff, but at the same time, like, you know, I've got, you know, my career, I've got my family, my kids in the phase of life that they're in, like, that'll come back to me. That's another thing. And I try to keep that in perspective of me, because, you know so well that, you know, it's so often the first thing on my mind when I wake up in the morning and the last thing before I go to bed. And that's just the fact of the matter is there's so much more. And I said this year, like, my main thing is really just trying to focus on priorities. And so that's one thing I've really enjoyed outside of agronomy, you know, just, you know, BSing with you over time. But, yeah, so we've been rolling for plenty long. So, Eric, thanks again for doing this. Hopefully this is helpful. I mean, this is the planning phase when it comes to food plots and stuff like that now. So
yeah,
plan
absolutely.
Now and work now.
Yeah,
work
it was enjoyable. I'm glad we were able to do it. And I would just let people know, like, if they have questions about food plots, like, you're the man. You know how to advise them. So reach out and let's get some successful food plots.
Absolutely. Well, hey, thanks again.
You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.